Good morning, and thank you to my colleagues, their staffs, and the many members of our bar impacted by the modifications of the hearing calendar this week on such short notice. I thank you for making the many changes to your schedules necessary for us to hear all four of the cases before us today. The man our nation will officially mourn tomorrow, President George Herbert Walker Bush, wore the uniform of his country with great distinction in addition to his lifetime of service to our great nation. His memory is most worthy of the flexibility and responsiveness you have given to the important business of this court. At this time, I'd like to ask for a moment of silence in the President's memory. Thank you. With that, the court calls United States versus Cooper. As this is a Judge Advocate General certified case, the government will go first. Is the government prepared? Is the appellee prepared? Government may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court. My name is Major Kelly O'Neill, and along with Colonel Mark Jamison, I represent the United States. Your Honor, the United States respectfully requests 3 minutes rebuttal time.
Granted.
Thank you, sir. Your Honors, the lower court's opinion should be set aside for three reasons. One, appellee's failure to request individual military counsel or to bring the issue before the military judge leaves nothing for this court to appeal. Unless, and for the second reason, under Strickland, appellee cannot show prejudice, and Strickland should apply.
Could you say number one again? I lost something there.
Appellee never requested IMC,
okay,
and never brought it to the military judge, okay, leaving an unpreserved, at most, an unpreserved error.
Okay, thank you.
And under Strickland, and as Strickland is the appropriate framework, and under that framework, appellee cannot show prejudice. And even reviewing the matter at hand for substantively for IMC deprivation, appellee cannot show Article 59A prejudice under Hutchins. So appellee's failure to bring either route a request to the government and put the government on notice that an IMC request was desired, assuming that's true, and the subsequent failure to bring that before the military judge and ask him to make findings of fact on the situation or attempt to remedy the error in the limited discretion he has.
Counsel, is it the government's position that this was waived?
Yes, Your Honor. It's waived in multiple reasons. And
well, I mean, the fact that he stood mute when he was asked about IMC by the military judge.
Absolutely.
And his counsel denied the whole thing. And when he was asked, he said nothing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Under Campos, that would be affirmative waiver. But even absent affirmative waiver, we have a situation where this court simply can't practically review anything because he never made a request prior to the court martial being released. He never, and so under Kamanga, it's just not a there's no timely request to act upon. And under 905E, his failure to bring RCM 905E, his failure to bring the issue to the attention of the military judge and request findings of fact.
Well, 905 really applies to a situation in which IMC has been asked for and denied, and that's not the situation. I mean, according to the government, that's not this situation.
Certainly, Your Honor. But okay. under any circumstance, there's simply no decision for the court to review. There's no decision of the convening authority, and there's no decision of the military judge to review.
Is it the government's position that he made this whole thing up?
Yes, Your Honor.
He didn't ask for it at all, or, you know, it sounds like he rattled his way through at least four judge advocates, all of whom had some problem or some imputed problem. What's the government's position on this? Did this take place, and he just never, I don't know, what's the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that the military judge erred finding that this request was ever made. as briefed in the issue. But, I mean, even assuming that the request was made and assuming the facts in a light most favorable to the appellant or the appellee, excuse me.
Counsel, let me stop you for just a minute. Now, you're taking issue with the military, the debate judge's findings?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that would mean that you think they are clearly erroneous, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
In other words, no support in the record?
It's not simply no support. It's the fact that there's such contradictory information. I mean, the United States agrees that there is evidence that appellee on the record said, I wanted this request, and Captain Newman, you know, followed up in the Dubé and said it. But the problem with the military judge's resolution and the resolution of that, the appellee statement versus Lieutenant JB's statement, the trial defense counsel's, is that he found both to be equally credible and both neither one to be misleading. And the unequivocal way.
Well, he didn't say equally credible, did he?
Well, he found them both.
That would be a problem if they were equally credible.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, he resolved the credibility issue in favor of the appellee. The issue.
And doesn't he have a right to do that? Isn't he the person down there looking at the beady eyes and the sweaty brow?
He certainly has to. And, you know, admittedly, it's a high burden to meet for clearly erroneous. But the issue really comes down to his assessment that Lieutenant JB was not in any way trying to mislead or otherwise mislead the court, yet he fails to recognize that she was unequivocal in testimony that request never happened, and that her logs, which meticulously recorded the fact, the other discussion she had about the other IMCs that appellee wanted to request and her discussion with that failed to even note a request for Captain Tien. And the problem really is coming down to the desire, the military or the Dubé judge's attempts to not call either one misleading, and it's just irreconcilable in light of the unequivocal testimony of both.
Okay, now here we're talking about all these JAGs he supposedly ran through.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're talking about the Army Guardsmen, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But
counsel, do we need to even find that issue in favor of the government in order to rule in favor of the government?
No, Your Honor, absolutely not. And that's, I mean, it's thoroughly laid out in the United States brief. But for the purposes right now, even assuming that everything appellee said was true, the fact is that there was unpreserved error. And because the error is unpreserved, this court can't find waiver, even disregarding affirmative waiver, or can't find error, because even disregarding affirmative waiver, there can't even be plain error for decisions that were never that never existed for the convening authority or the military judge. And that's exactly why the framework of IAC is not the only standard by which the appellee can gain any semblance of relief or get any substantive relief of the issue whatsoever.
Can I go back and ask you a question about the debate hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your point that it could be true that appellee had conversations with his legal assistance attorney, Captain Newman, and said, I then talked to him about the case, but that doesn't mean that an IMC request was made?
Correct, Your Honor. An internal discussion between the person he purportedly wants to request as an IMC does not serve as a request.
Just out of curiosity, I know that trial counsel have to be detailed to a case. Are legal assistance attorneys authorized to seek to have a attorney-client relationship for a criminal case?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Not without proper authority under the Army regulations. As legal assistance attorneys, they are limited to legal assistance matters, and they're not to go beyond the purview of that without a specific authorization. Not even just for legal assistance attorneys, no Army judge advocate is authorized to form an attorney-client relationship without specific authorization.
Well, what if it falls out of heaven?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What if you're talking to this guy, and you start talking about stuff, and bang, 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 and suddenly you got what would be in any other circumstance an attorney-client relationship. But there's this rig floating around out there that says you can't have an attorney-client relationship. Does that mean the government can jimmy its way in there? What does it mean?
The distinction, Your Honor, makes is with this idea that if some of the conversations happens to kind of cross the threshold a little bit. They may be somewhat confidential communications that can't be breached and that are protected, but that doesn't form it into an ongoing and viable attorney-client relationship under Spriggs. What has to happen for there is not only a bilateral mutual agreement of of understanding of the scope of representation, but also but that there has to be active preparation in pretrial strategy and other kinds of litigation. And even simply having a discussion with the detailed trial counsel saying, hey, this is my impression over, you know, these legal assistance communications I had with them is not the same thing as active pretrial preparation.
Well, no, I think what you're talking about is an ongoing attorney-client relationship that mutates into criminal defense. That wasn't really my question. My question is, they engage in this conversation under the aegis of legal assistance, which I remember I did a million times, usually because somebody wanted a will. Talking about the will, and then suddenly they're talking about his problems, and then suddenly he's divulging confidentialities. I think what you're saying is the government would not be able to pry its way into that on the strength of the regulation, but it's not a continuing regulation. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor, because the attorney-client relationship is limited also by the scope, and the scope is, in this case, legal assistance. And the lower court found that there was an exceeding of the scope of legal assistance in this case. But that's the scope, and when that scope is completed, when that purview is completed, the ongoing nature of the attorney-client relationship is done. And simply because there was some crossover that would arguably be confidential doesn't turn it into an attorney-client relationship.
Well, it doesn't turn it into a continuing attorney-client, is what, you know.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right.
And that's important because that's what's required to avail yourself of the attorney-client relationship protection when you're making a request for an individual military counsel. In order to be able to attempt to circumvent some of the per se prohibitions of individual military counsel, you have to be able to claim an ongoing attorney-client relationship under Spriggs. And that requires an improper denial is made, then that could lead to an improper severance. But that, too, should be brought before the military judge for a purpose of review. And at no point has appellate...
Well, you're not saying it's disqualifying. You're saying that it isn't without more enough, I think is what you're saying.
Well, certainly the United States isn't claiming there was any per se disqualification. But that's how I believe that your question dealing with the attorney-client relationship relates to this case specifically is...
If we could just turn to a slightly different question, let's assume, for the sake of argument, and I'm not asking you to concede this, that he did request that this person be his IMC, right, to his defense counsel, though not formally, and did not bring it up to the judge, and no action was taken on it, right? So he did not get the IMC, he did not get the counsel that he desired to have. Can you turn to the question whether... that is a statutory violation or a constitutional violation, and why?
Yes, Your Honor, it's a pure statutory violation. The constitutional protections for, in this case specifically, choice of counsel is the floor of the protections. But constitutional choice of counsel only applies to those that are retained and paid for by the appellee, which is not the case here.
Counsel, on that point, Gonzales-Lopez case says, and you're correct about that, but in terms of prejudice, why isn't this structural? If we assume that there is ineffective, if we assume that there was an error and we're analyzing this under ineffective assistance of counsel, why isn't this structural error? I mean, I understand that it's not a Sixth Amendment case under your position, but why isn't, if there's a statutory right to have the counsel of your choice, why isn't it a structural error? If he doesn't get the counsel that he wants?
Because first, the only cases that are permitted to be just presumed prejudice without some sort of showing is structural error, which by default is going to be a constitutional violation. Second, it disregards, assuming it's a statutory error, it disregards the plain language of Article 59A, which requires a finding of prejudice prior to gaining relief. And third, under the constitutional evaluation under Strickland, when Strickland is implied, it requires not simply a finding of error or deficiency in that case, but also specific prejudice above and beyond even just Article 59A. And so that's why there's simply no way to resolve the issue if it's a pure statutory violation.
Counsel, and now you got me puzzled.
Please continue.
Number one, we're not talking about 59 here. We're talking about structural error, which is basically something that is so inherent in the system that the mere fact of its existence is deemed to be reversible error. Number two, it doesn't have a thing to do with Strickland. Strickland is a whole different standard. It seems to me the problem you've got with IMC is that you can't show prejudice or non-prejudice, because to do that is to engage in the intellectual exercise of he got counsel X, but he wanted counsel Y. Would counsel Y have been better? Would counsel Y have done 1, 2, 3 that he claims counsel X didn't do? We don't know, and we can't know. Isn't that the real reason why this could be structural error?
No, Your Honor, because first it disregards the idea that structural error is constitutional error. But for purposes of statute...
And who says that?
Every case that has dealt with structural error, including this court in Brooks, identifies certain limited fundamental rights, which are constitutional. Glasser says those are the constitutional rights.
Well, did we hold that only constitutional error can be structural, or did we hold that in every case we've held it to be structural, it happened to be constitutional?
Well, Your Honor, I agree that you did not hold that.
Okay.
But if you take it back from the framework of Glasser, which talks about these fundamental rights as constitutional errors, and Arizona v. Fulminante and all the other Supreme Court cases that deal with it that say these structural errors are violations of fundamental rights that affect the framework of the Constitution.
Okay, well...
So what is your point, that there's a constitutional fundamental right to have counsel of your choice that you pay for, right? But this other thing is a statutory right.
Correct, Your Honor.
So long as they have counsel, it has to be analyzed under IAC.
Correct, Your Honor. And to find otherwise, to disregard the requirement to show prejudice, would go beyond the scope of the protections offered by the plain language of the Constitution and the Code, as this Court held in Vasquez.
So what's your point? What's your position on IAC? I mean, if he asked her to get this IMC, and if she neglected to do so, why isn't that IAC?
It's not IAC because at this point, Appellee has identified nothing in the record that would have changed the nature of the evidence that would result in a substantial probability of a different result at trial. And in the context of IAC, that's the prejudice requirement.
So we could say that she acted unreasonably, right, in a way that your average attorney would not have, and so your position then is that but there's no prejudice in the Strickland sense.
And this Court doesn't even have to reach the effectiveness aspect or the deficiency aspect to find no prejudice. But that's correct, Your Honor. There has to still be specific prejudice.
Getting to the Chief Judge's point, how would, in any case, there be a showing of prejudice?
I think this Court's...
Go ahead.
I think this Court, the way the Court evaluated in Hutchins, is really just a next step from Hutchins. It's not about comparing relative value as far as, you know, this person would have done it better. It's about looking at what the absence of that, how the absence of that attorney, if even reasonably available, impacted the overall assessment. So you can look at what different strategies may have been raised. Did that particular attorney have any kind of special expertise that the representing attorney did not, that would help them change the nature of the evidence? But at the end of the day, Your Honor, when it comes to Strickland, that becomes the appellant's burden because it is not preserved at trial. And if the Court has no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the appellee.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the Court. May it please the Court. I'm Major Marianne McGuire. I'm joined by Captain Andrew House, and I represent the appellee, Wyan Tu Cooper.
Could you speak up a little, Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The preliminary question before this court is whether or not this is a choice of counsel case or whether or not this is an effective assistance of counsel case. The answer to this question matters because there is a different legal analysis that applies to these two different rights. We believe the lower court got it right, that while counsel, because of her special role under RCM 506, is the primary reason why Andrew Cooper was deprived of this right, that ultimately this is a choice of counsel case. The Supreme Court in Gonzalez-Lopez stated that the right to counsel of choice is derived from the Sixth Amendment. While the Sixth Amendment does not require the government to provide an IMC, once the government elects to provide this discretionary right, this discretionary choice, that choice then falls under the protections that the Supreme Court stated in Gonzalez-Lopez as choice of counsel rights. Under the facts of this case, even if this court analyzes this as an ineffective assistance of counsel case, YN2 Cooper still prevails both under the two prejudice prongs that the government asserts, but also under the way that we believe this court should assess prejudice. My intent is to address the different frameworks available for the court to assess the error in this case. Before I get there, I want to discuss why this issue is not waived. This issue isn't waived because under the Alano case, we know that there's different levels, different requirements in order for there to be a valid waiver. Whether a waiver has to be intelligent and knowingly made depends on the right at stake. So what is the right at stake here? If the right at stake here is that YN2 Cooper didn't get the effective assistance of counsel that he deserved, then there's no waiver because IAC trumps waiver. However, if this is ultimately a choice of counsel case, you have to decide what is the level, the requirement in order for that waiver to be knowing and intelligent. And in Kinyard, 1972, this court said that the right to IMC, and they equated it to the right to civilian counsel, is one of the most fundamental rights that an accused has. Even if this court doesn't believe that the right to IMC is constitutional and just statutory, there are many statutory rights that must be knowing and intelligently made for a valid waiver to take effect. Examples include the right to counsel before accepting a summary court-martial, that's the Booker case, right to submit matters in clemency, that's a Rosenthal case, right to an Article 32 hearing. There's many statutory rights that in order for there to be an effective waiver, it has to be knowing and intelligently made. So if you believe this is the requirement is that the waiver has to be knowing and intelligent, you then must decide under the facts of this case whether or not a military accused who has been misinformed and misled that his requests for IMC have been denied, when he tells the military judge that he wants Lieutenant B to represent him, whether or not that is a knowing and intelligent decision.
Where did the debate hearing judge say that he was intentionally misled?
So
you just said that's what happened, and I don't read the debate hearing findings of fact that way.
So the debate judge went through the testimony of YN2 Cooper and said that he was misled regarding his request to IMC, that he had requested specifically the first attorney, Commander M, he had requested the second attorney, Captain Tien, and he had requested the third attorney, Captain JN, and that based upon the information he received from his attorney, that those requests were all denied. So in YN2 Cooper's mind, this is what the debate judge found, YN2 Cooper's mind, he had requested those attorneys, and those attorneys were all denied. So that when the military judge asked him, who do you want to represent you, under his mind, they had all been denied, so he had nobody else to request because all of his requests had previously been denied.
But you said intentionally misled.
I apologize, Judge Ryan. If I said intentional, I believe he said misled. I don't know whether he said intentional or not. I'd have to go back to the debate.
Do you agree that makes a difference?
I don't believe it makes a difference because if the standard is what the appellant at the CCA level, if the standard is what he knows and whether his waiver is intelligent, I don't think whether or not Lieutenant B intentionally misled him matters.
If it's a statutory right, does it have to be the same level of knowledge?
So in Olano, the Supreme Court did not distinguish between constitutional rights and other fundamental rights. So it's the fundamental nature of the right. And the inquiry is, does the right protect fairness? Does it protect the integrity of the judicial process? Does it protect public perception of the judicial process, regardless of whether it's a constitutional right or a statutory right?
How do you go from he may have been not understood the IMC to he got an unfair trial?
So this is...
I mean, that goes to the ineffective assistance of counsel point, right?
Right. And that's why we believe that the CCA got it right in finding that this is a choice of counsel case. Because ultimately, while both the right to counsel of choice and the right to effective assistance both fall under the Sixth Amendment, there are two separate prongs of the Sixth Amendment. The reason that there's a prejudice prong when you're testing for IAC goes to the root meaning of the right to effective assistance of counsel. The reason we have that right is because of the fairness. In this adversarial system, you have a prosecutor on one side, and on your side, under Gideon and Johnson, you need to have an attorney there so he can marshal the facts in your favor and present your case. And without that, the trial isn't fair.
So he did have an attorney, right?
He did have an attorney, Judge Ryan, yes. But ultimately, because the question, when you're deprived of your right to choose your IMC, it's not an issue of fairness of the trial. It's an issue of, were you deprived of that constitutional right or statutory right to have the individual that you think is going to best represent your interests in the court-martial? So it doesn't...
Counsel, on that point, the government says that if it's just a statutory right and you've been denied it, that we can't assess it for, we can't view it as structural error. Do you agree with that?
So I don't agree with that. While there is no Supreme Court case that has applied structural error to a non-constitutional right, there may be some dicta in the Nieder case to support that position. Lower courts have applied structural error to rights that are statutory in nature. For example, there's some lower court cases that apply structural error when an individual is deprived of his right to a 12-person jury, but we know that that's not a constitutional right. This court has applied structural error in Beatty and Hartfield to the right to IMC, which if you believe it is a statutory right, it has you have applied structural error in that instance.
So if we were to conclude that counsel made an error that fell below the Strickland standard, and we could conclude that the relief should be granted because there was structural error. So again, if we decide this as an IAC case, that it would be enough to find it as a structural error.
I believe
without additional prejudice.
I believe so, but I think under if you go that route, if you go through the Strickland analysis, there would still need to be an initial showing of deficient performance.
If we determine that there was deficient performance, we met that prong. The other prong, the prejudice prong, could be satisfied, even though this is a statutory right under a view of structural error.
That's right. That's right.
So what do you do about the fact that the Supreme Court created this doctrine and discussed it entirely within the construct of constitutional rights and constitutional error and the inability of the government in such a case to prove that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which again presupposes a constitutional error?
So I understand that in Gonzalez-Lopez the issue was it was a harmless error analysis
not just Gonzalez-Lopez, I mean from the very beginning of the structural error doctrine.
So I would have to argue that in the McCoy case, which the CCA didn't have the benefit of the McCoy case because it was decided after the CCA issued its decision in this case, that in the McCoy case, what the Supreme Court did is they declined to apply Strickland when counsel's error deprive the client of the autonomous right. And we would argue that the right to choose counsel of choice, in this case IMC, is an autonomous right equivalent to the right that the Supreme Court decided in the McCoy case.
That doesn't really answer my question about what do you do about the fact that this whole doctrine arose in the context of constitutional error. And that even then, the Supreme Court said that it's a very rare case, a very rare case, where they will devolve to that standard.
So I think you have to look at the...
Because, I mean, I don't think you can disagree that, you know, that expanding this to encompass violations of statutory rights would be rather unprecedented.
Right, and I agree that in the dicta of the Supreme Court cases where they're applying structural error, that they seem to be focusing on constitutional rights. However, if you look at the reason why they're applying structural error, there's really three reasons under the Weaver decision. There's really only one at play with choice of counsel issues. And the reason you apply structural error to a counsel of choice issue, such as Gonzalez-Lopez case, is because it is just too hard to assess prejudice. You would have to figure out what would have happened in an alternative universe. In the government's brief, they believe that, you know, that there's no record.
That would encompass so many things. I mean, that would encompass so many things. There's so many things that you couldn't really tell whether it would have made a difference or not. So many statutory rights, so many statutory authorizations that you couldn't tell.
Judge Ryan, I disagree. I think you have to look at what the exact right is. So with an ineffective assistance case, you have the entire court martial process. And an ineffective assistance counsel case doesn't vest until you can look at the end of the process and say, hey, this wasn't fair. But because the right to choice of counsel infects the framework in which the process occurs, I think the analysis has to be,
Let me put it a slightly different way. Can you point to anything in this trial that you believe a different counsel could have done better or differently that would have changed the result?
Ryan, certainly. I think there's many issues. This was a very factually weak case. The victim herself admitted to consenting to sexual intercourse with my client. She claimed that she was in this tonically immobile, which means that she was able to think that she didn't want to consent, but she couldn't act on that. She couldn't say that she didn't want to consent, and she couldn't take any actions indicating that she did not want to consent. Now, the burden of proof in this case for the government was that they had to prove lack of consent. So had a different defense counsel marshaled that evidence, either through better cross-examination of the expert witness, better cross-examination of the victim, calling their own expert witness to rebut the testimony of the government's witness.
What specifically? Like, was there a problem with the expert witness? Is this a concept of tonic immobility that doesn't have any support in the field?
So
is it inappropriate to bear testimony? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand. I don't think the theory of tonic immobility is a scientifically robust and recognized medical event. And so I think a DeBart hearing to test whether or not that expert should have been qualified in the first instance.
There have been other tonic immobility cases where there hasn't been a DeBart hearing called on that expert?
There are not many tonic immobility cases out there, Judge Ryan, and that's the problem.
I'd never heard of it before, so that's not surprising.
That's a problem. It's a novel issue. So to not test the expert's qualifications fell below what a normal detailed defense counsel would have done. She only called two witnesses in the defense case in chief. There were many more she could have called. The case in sentencing, it was bare bones and sparse. The client, Y.N.T. Cooper, had informed her of many sentencing witnesses that she should have talked to. She failed to make those inquiries to determine whether or not she could put on a more robust sentencing case. I mean, every aspect of this case could be analyzed, but the problem is we don't have those findings of fact before us right now because the lower court found the other AOEs dealing with ineffectiveness moot because they decided that this case was a choice of counsel case, not an ineffective assistance of counsel case, and they declined to judgment proof their decision by ruling on the cumulative error IAC issue. Had they done that, I think we could have that detailed discussion about prejudice under Strickland for this particular defense counsel.
And I'm sorry for not knowing this. Was there a DeBay hearing on the IAC question?
So
was that issue raised?
That's interesting, Judge Ryan. So when this went back to the DuBay, the court had not decided the framework in which they were going to analyze the issue. So it wasn't clear whether or not they were going to analyze it as a choice of counsel issue or an IAC issue. One of the very interesting things that happened at the DuBay hearing was that Y&T Cooper's DuBay counsel, when Captain TN was on the stand, asked Captain TN the very specific question, what would you have done differently? Set the stage, explained that Captain TN knew the case better than anybody else. He had reviewed the record in his capacity as a private investigator, asked the question, what would you have done differently?
Here's another question. Like, was he supposed to be doing that? Right, you know, you just said as a private investigator, and I mean, and this sort of begs the question, and it may not be important, but it bothers me that basically a legal assistant's attorney took it upon themselves to say, I'd like to be your IMC, and I'm going to privately investigate this case.
So, Judge, if I may just clear up the facts. So at the time that he was acting in his capacity as a private investigator, he had been released from active duty. He was a guardsman. He wasn't on active duty orders. So at this time, he's doing it in his private capacity, not his military capacity.
But he began the process while he was on active duty as a legal assistance attorney, right?
Right, and that may be an issue with him violating Army regulations and with him.
Was he compensated?
I do not know the answer to that question.
I share Judge Ryan's, you know, this whole thing had its start when he was on active duty. And now suddenly he's gotten a civilian job out of it where he's opining on all this stuff. And I don't know whether it gives me the willies, but it comes close.
Right, and I believe that he was doing this free of charge, although I'm not willing to go that far because I don't have a record site to point you to.
Okay, go ahead.
Counsel, may I return your attention to the issue of waiver, please? Now, much of the focus here has been on the following colloquy between the military judge and counsel, where the military judge said, has individual military counsel been requested in this case? And then trial defense counsel said, no, sir. But on JA-79, there's the following interaction directly between the military judge and the accused, where the military judge says, do you wish to be represented by any other counsel, either civilian or military? And the accused says, no, sir, I do not. So that was not a technical question. It was not ambiguous. It was not unclear. It was direct. There was no interlocutor here. If we were to ignore that type of exchange in the context of waiver, how would we not be turning our waiver precedents on its head?
So Judge Olson, at that point in time where there's that discussion between Y&T Cooper and the military judge, Y&T Cooper had already asserted his rights under RCM 506. He had gone to his defense counsel, and he had said, hey, I want this person, that person.
But isn't the reason for that colloquy so that if there is some sort of pre-discussion with the defense counsel, that it gives the accused the opportunity to have a one-on-one tete with the military judge, and regardless of what his defense counsel say, no, I want F. Lee Bailey, or no, I want Captain N. I mean, isn't that the purpose of the military judge asking the accused specifically, even though he's already asked the judge, he's already asked the counsel?
Yes,
Judge. That's the purpose.
Yes, Judge. I believe in the Donahue case, this court did say that that was one of the purposes to ensure that if there is a waiver, that it is made knowingly. However, in this case, Y&T Cooper, and the way we have set up the right to assert the right under 506, he had already asserted the right to his defense counsel. That request had been denied. His request for all three had been denied. So,
counsel, he's gone through IMCs or putative IMCs like Kleenex. He seems to have this burning desire to have anybody defend him except who he's got. And the judge is saying, well, do you want somebody else? And he says, no, Your Honor. I mean, if that isn't waiver, there is no waiver.
Yes, Your Honor, and we would disagree that he's going through counsel like Kleenex. He's a reservist. He is activated. He happens to be co-located in an office.
I spent 21 years a reservist. I know something about it. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. So he's in an office co-located with other judge advocates. These are three judge advocates that, and I realize I'm out of time. If I may
finish
the thought, these are three judge advocates that he knows. So he requests the three that he knows. He's out of options at that point because he doesn't know any beyond this three. So by the time he goes to the military judge and he's asked, hey, who else do you want? He doesn't know anybody else. And His detailed defense.
He doesn't have to pick somebody. The judge isn't asking him to pick somebody. The judge is saying, do you want somebody else? And he's saying, no.
Right, and his detailed defense counsel had known that at the point. Even if we take her Dubé testimony at its word, that he only requested two, not three. Prior to this discussion between Wyant and Cooper and the military judge, she had already told the judge on the record that there hadn't been any IMC requests made. So at this point in time, you would require Wyant and Cooper to go against and essentially stand up and tell the military judge that what she is saying is a lie.
But that's the whole point of the military judge asking the question.
Exactly.
Right? Because what other purpose would there be? It's to give them the chance. It's like when they say, yeah, I want to plead guilty, and they say, has anyone made any promises or threats to make you plead guilty? Right? It's so that they can say, well, actually, Your Honor, my defense counsel twisted my arm, and I really don't want to plead guilty. I mean, isn't that the point of him asking the accused that question?
I think so, Judge Ryan, but I would point to the Hartfield case in which it was also a request for IMC where a appellant was specifically requested an IMC. RCM 506 procedures weren't followed. The request didn't go all the way up to the convening authority who had approval authority. So it was never a totally denied request. But this court still found that silence on the record in Hartfield didn't equate to waiver because he had been misinformed about his IMC request that he has made. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to respond to a few of Appelli's points. First, the distinction Appelli makes with regard to Weaver and the type of error involved is not quite correct because in Weaver, the issue involved was public trial, which the court likened to one of those structural errors where prejudice was hard to determine, like Gonzalez-Lopez and the choice of counsel. And they hesitated in cases to apply Strickland to even structural errors. They hesitated in cases that are going to be presumed to be fundamentally unfair in cases of certain counsel inaction. That's not Gonzalez-Lopez. But in all other cases, they said that Strickland could be appropriate. Further, a police citation in McCoy has a real factual distinction that needs to be brought before the court. McCoy did deal with with defense action, but that was objected to in front of the judge, and the judge allowed the defense counsel to argue guilt over specific objections. So there was a government/judicial duty for them to reconcile the issue right there. They distinguished Florida v. Nixon, where in that case the petitioner did not make an objection at trial. So McCoy is not persuasive for the idea that Strickland should be rejected. Furthermore, Appelli's comment that other lower courts apply structural error is not binding on this court, and the idea of going beyond what is clearly required by the plain text of the Constitution and the Code and the rules will run contrary to this court's holding in United States v. Vasquez, which said that is how service members are protected, and going beyond that is an amorphous concept of military due process that has been rejected. And if, in fact, that and Appelli's attempts to disregard Strickland and the burden that Strickland would impose on them for an unpreserved error in favor of arguing structural error for a statutory violation is simply an attempt to recast an error as prejudice, which is an ipsy dixit recasting of prejudice, which is simply contrary to Puckett.
Has there been a debate hearing on the issue of IAC?
The way the lower court
Were there findings of fact and conclusions of law by a debate hearing judge on the questions of IAC?
Not specifically, Your Honor. The lower court's issues kind of rotate around whether there was requests made, et cetera. So it was framed a little more substantively than that. And there was no real question of prejudice associated with that. And then
So let's say, assuming without deciding that we were to say Well, it appears that this question of IMC was waived, but that nonetheless leaves open the question of IAC, and on that point we haven't had a debate hearing, and one is needed. What would you think of that?
Your Honor, if the court doesn't feel they have enough information on the record, they could certainly remand for a further 60.
I mean, isn't IAC usually decided at a debate hearing? I mean, isn't it usually sent to a debate hearing and resolved by a debate hearing judge, at least in the first instance?
If under Jin there's a requirement for resolution of material fact that will impact the specific case. But as the United States said, even taking the military judge's findings as adopting the military judge's and CCA's findings, the appellee has not made a showing of prejudice.
Counsel, let me ask you a question getting back to the waiver issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
What do you make of the CCA's statement when they're setting out the findings of the debate judge on the issue of waiver? And they make this statement. As the record supports these findings, they are not clearly erroneous. We also conclude that the appellant communicated to Lieutenant B his desire to request Captain N as an IMC, and that Lieutenant B responded in a way that led the appellant to believe that Captain M was not available. So it seems to me that you'd have to find the debate judge clearly erroneous, you'd have to find the CCA clearly erroneous, and then you'd have to require the accused during the trial, once he's under this misapprehension, so to speak, to do something that he really doesn't have to do, it seems to me. It's a doing of an unnecessary thing for him to respond to the military judge. Yes, I requested an IMC, but he was unavailable.
Well, yes, Your Honor. In terms of his obligations at court, that's absolutely.
You're saying that he was required, the accused would have been required to say that.
In order to invoke some sort of duty on the military judge to respond to the government. At this point, it's uncontested that either the government or the
military. Right, but it goes to my question of whether or not this is an intelligent waiver, so to speak. In other words, if this is the misapprehension that the accused is under, when the military judge asks him if he wants to be represented by any other individual military counsel, he's thinking in his mind, I guess, is that, well, I've asked for these other people. I've been told they're unavailable. Why do I need to say I want to be represented by someone I've already been told is unavailable? I mean, that seems like an imposition on the accused that is not warranted.
Judge Sparks, I mean, you make it an excellent point because that's the whole reason why Strickland and IAC is the framework under which this applied. Because at no point
right, but I'm in the other mode that if this in fact is a choice of counsel question, as the CCA thought it to be, I understand your position. I'm asking you to argue against your own position. I understand that. But if this is a choice of counsel, it may not be. I may be the lone soldier up here. But if that is the case, it seems to me that making the accused come forward to tell the military judge, or saying that that's his burden to do that, to tell the military judge I requested someone, he was not available, seems a bit much to me.
If we assume choice of counsel is involved, then what happened, as Judge Ryan pointed out in the Lee concurrence, he made a choice. When asked who he wanted to be represented by, he chose his counsel. And so without government interference with that choice, or even assuming it was based off faulty information, that doesn't invoke an erroneous desire of choice of counsel because the government was not on notice and there was no interference. Government or a judicial interference with his choice.
But the choice of counsel right shouldn't have to rely on who's denying the accused the right, should it? I mean, it doesn't matter. He still gets his right denied.
No, Your Honor. Especially when invoking structural error, which are predicated on constitutional deprivations of constitutional rights, which under Glasser is encompassed in the Bill of Rights, other than individual assistance of counsel and effective assistance of counsel, All those violations are predicated on a government or judicial.
I understand that's your position. So, Chief Judge, I know I'm taking counsel over their time, but I have one additional question. And it is this. Now, you say you get around in your brief this court's cases in Hartfield and Beatty by saying they simply should be set aside, right? They should be overturned because they say that this is a fundamental right, right? And you disagree with that, of course, and you say we should overturn those cases. But in the issue of stare decisis, what specific element or criteria under stare decisis would we overturn those cases?
Yes, Your Honor. For Hartfield specifically, Hartfield's finding of a fundamental right and presumed prejudice is cited directly to Glasser, which did not involve choice of counsel. It involved a conflict of counsel, which it has been found to be concurrent representation of clients with adverse interests over the client's objections is structural error. So to use Glasser to support the idea that a statutory right is also structural, and they admit it's structural. Right.
So that would be the wrongly decided element?
Correct.
Okay.
And in Beatty, not only that, you follow on with Beatty's idea that this court's admonition in Vasquez to stick to the plain language of the Constitution, Code, and RCM in determining rights does not support the expansion of a statutory right to does not support the expansion of finding of getting relief for statutory right absent a showing of specific prejudice when not raised on appeal.
Okay, so that's the same prong of the with the same element of the stare decisis doctrine.
And also simply Hutchins, which also dealt with the statutory right, said you cannot presume prejudice when you're dealing with interference of a statutory rights counsel.
Okay. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted. Court is in recess till 0900.